I'm Tammy Haddad. Welcome to the Washington AI Network with a very special guest, Tiffany Moore, SVP of Political and Industry Affairs. She covers it all for the Consumer Technology Association. Welcome, Tiffany.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, how about this global innovation scorecard? Only you guys would be willing to look at the whole world and tell us what's what and who's winning. Who's winning?
Well, first, I'd love to talk about CES. It's a global show, and I think that was the reason and the direction for the Global Innovation Scorecard. As you know, we had over 141,000 attendees, but 40% of them were international from over 150 countries, regions, and territories. And given the show is so global, we thought the opportunity to showcase global innovation and what countries are doing it right was the perfect opportunity for CTA and CES.
That's incredible. I didn't realize that there are that many countries participating, but the U.S. is still number one, right?
You know, we've got some work to do to stay in that number one position.
Okay.
We have always been an innovation champion, but there are so many countries that are in that top tier category, innovation champions, which is the highest level a country could be. But there are so many countries chomping at the bit, known as innovation leaders, who are ready to claim that number one spot. We like to believe in the U.S. that we have kind of this special innovation and entrepreneurial piece that's part of our DNA. But so many other countries are starting to catch on, and they are actually making it very competitive. When you look at global companies, they often now have their pick of countries that where they can invest in and headquarter in.
Well, you know, I was at the Paris AI Summit, and there was a lot of conversation about other countries in addition to what's happening in the U.S. So you evaluated 74 countries and the EU as a whole.
Okay. Yes.
Tell us what you've learned from this.
I guess we'll start by saying that policies matter. For the first time, the European Union is actually not an innovation champion, given some of the policies that they put forth over the last couple of years. And that's why, you know, they were kind of separated out. But given some of the restrictive policies, you know, we're all familiar with the EU AI Act and some other GDPR privacy, some of those items definitely affected their standing within our global innovation scorecard. But if you look at a lot of the countries that are winning or in that top category, great countries like Ireland, Luxembourg, and also New Zealand, but broadly South Korea, Spain, Switzerland, the UK, and of course, the United States.
And what surprised you? Because this is the fourth time you've done this report.
Well, the interesting thing and what we kind of consider our secret sauce is like, we do use kind of publicly available information and indices, but we also kind of add some, you know, we sprinkle some tech dust on it, I would say. And we look at specific items like openness to digital platforms, openness to self-driving vehicles, telehealth. When we're looking at digital assets, is there a structure for it within the country? Is it welcomed? So those are the types of things that we grade ourselves in addition to kind of your traditional metrics. So technologies of the future is the category that we call it. And is it blockchain friendly? Is it open to autonomous vehicles? Those are things that we are advocating for here in the United States when it comes to national policy and something that we welcome seeing in other countries as well.
And how much does this scorecard influence international collaboration and trade policies?
Well, you know, in this current moment when we're probably experiencing a trade war that we've never seen before, our innovation champions typically exemplify, you know, the transformative power of collaboration and working with your allies. But obviously, things have changed over the last year, and that kind of understanding and belief in a global trading system has kind of shifted and is not necessarily universally agreed upon as it had been in past years. So we don't think we've seen this trade war at the scale that it is in almost a century. And it's challenging leaders, global leaders all over, that how do we maintain that global trading system that's produced a great global tech boom and that's going to deliver the best and greatest prosperity in world history?
Oh, Tiffany, I meant to talk to you about this. I think you have to change CTA. I know you're globally famous to CTAI.
Well, you know, artificial intelligence is ingredient technology and it's everywhere. So I wouldn't be surprised if that I all of a sudden appears.
Stay with us, folks. In a minute, we're going to hear from the Global Innovation Scorecard Leaders. Tiffany Moore, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. And stay tuned because in April, we will be unveiling our most recent state scorecard that grades the states on innovation.
Excellent. We look forward to that. Thanks again, Tiffany Moore from CTA.
Thanks, Tammy.
And now to my conversation at CTA's Innovation House on Capitol Hill with Luxembourg Ambassador Nicole Bittner, Irish Ambassador Geraldine Byrne-Nason, and New Zealand Ambassador Rosemary Banks.
Thank you so much. We have these three incredible ambassadors here. They're global champions. Nicole, can I start with you? Because tiny Luxembourg is a badass country. What you guys have done there in innovation, can you talk about how you have become a champion and what you guys have been specifically doing?
Thanks so much, Tammy. And thank you so much, Tiffany, for having me here. So how do you get to become a champion? I think the first is probably to be very humble. When you look at the history we've gone through, and I don't want to give a history lesson, don't worry about that, but we were a really very poor agrarian country, which had to innovate and to find ways of surviving, which is why we lost about one third of our population, which emigrated to this country and created the wealth of this country. So we discovered iron ore, we developed the steel sector, but then iron ore, you know, the good of the earth, runs out after a while. So we had to reinvent ourselves again, which is when we went more into services, developed the financial sector, and then tried to go into different niches. So it's this kind of permanently question yourself and how you move forward. We are a tiny country, as you say, so we cannot do everything. So the idea is to find the niches where we can actually bring value, trying to move forward and not stay on the status quo. There are other issues, but maybe I just leave it at that for the time being.
Is there a sector that was unexpectedly successful?
I think people mostly, of course, no, Luxembourg for the financial sector and the diversity, so especially in the investment funds. And then I think a sector which is quite known in the US is the space sector. So we've been doing a lot of work in the space sector because we really started to develop commercial space. I think that's what people probably would not expect so much because we used sovereign rights we had to start really commercial broadcasting. So we had the first commercial broadcasting and then from there we developed commercial space activities.
Okay, Geraldine, Ireland. There you are, global champion. Let's hear it for them. Their big day is coming. Although as someone who's honorary Irish, every day is your day.
So, well, in 1 week's time, everybody in this room will either be honorary Irish or want to be Irish. So, so we're warming up for our big St. Patrick's thing. But listening to Nicole there, I'm just struck by the evolutionary side of it. You know, Ireland, the Ireland I was born into was an island of 2.9 million people. Agrarian. And in my lifetime, we're now 7 million people on the island, dynamic global leader in particularly tech, pharma, financial services. It's been an extraordinary evolution, but it didn't happen by accident. So in our case, if I mark one major change in the period, it was, of course, our membership of the European Union in 1974. But there was a decided strategic approach by the Irish government through the 1960s to link a sort of a very open global trading posture, business posture by the government to industry and to academia. So we grew our educational sector in a way into our economic ambition. We opened up education for all, and now we have the most highly educated population in Europe by any standards. We also have the highest STEM graduate per capita in Europe. So I'm constantly asked about how Ireland emerged as a tech digital hub, as we are. And I always say that we put our money into brains and not roads. So we invested in a third level education system that has actually been an attraction in itself for multinational corporations. And we have a highly skilled young pipeline force. If you look at our map, you'll notice that in parts of the country regionally, say on the west coast of Ireland, where we have a lot of bio and medical device companies,
the universities in that area are specialized in those graduate programs. The tax credits for R&D track the educational and industry evolution. So this is actually quite a purposeful path. And then the fact that Ireland is an English-speaking language environment on the edge of Europe, initially we're peripheral, we have no natural resources. So we trade on our own wit in many ways, but we are a gateway to 500 million consumers, 500 million industrial opportunities in Europe by being a member of the European Union. So we pulled all that together, as I say, in a purposeful way with a series of programs by the government. The Irish government has always thought that being a stable choice was important. I often hear from industry, from investors, particularly in disruptive technologies, they need an environment where they know from both an investment and a tax point of view, there's stability. So that's something that we offer on an ongoing basis. Almost irrespective of the political colour of the Irish government, you get that on offer.
Rosemary, New Zealand, you are ranked in the top 10 in all of these categories: act screening, actual diversity, fundamental freedoms, maintains pro-innovation legal environment, and startup and small business friendly. You guys are very busy there.
Indeed, but I'll go back to your starter question. How did we come to be an innovation champion? I think in our case, it probably goes back to being a really isolated, geographically distant country. We couldn't turn to any centres of expertise or learning nearby us. So right from our earliest days of existence, we had to have a can-do, can-invent, can-fix this problem attitude. Just going back a little bit in our early innovations, we had a Nobel Prize-winning scientist, Lord Ernest Rutherford, and to a point that Geraldine just made about not having a great deal of money at a certain point, he had a great line. He said, "We have no money, so we have to think." And relatively, that's probably still true. He was the scientist who split the atom. So that was our achievement in the early part of the 20th century. We had already in the 19th century, to meet the needs of our exports, invented refrigerated shipping containers. Also, because of our shallow river system, we invented the jet boat. And very prosaically, we invented the egg beater in 1919, you know, the one that you turn the handle on. And bouncing forward into the present, we do have a government that has put a great deal of effort into encouraging innovation and tech. And so we have now earned a reputation in such areas as biotech, clean tech, agri-tech, and also like Luxembourg, and very surprisingly for New Zealand, in space technology. A startup company just 10 years ago, Rocket Lab, didn't even really exist. They're now a US-listed company. And believe it or not, your sort of stunning and almost irrelevant fact of the day, New Zealand is now the third most frequent rocket-launching country in the world, equal with Russia. But we're much nicer.
So I have to ask all three of you, I just got back from the Paris AI Summit. The biggest issue there was how can business work with government? Every company was there. And it was such a push. You put all the glitz and glamour aside, as that government has to work together with industry to move ahead. So I wonder, let's start with Luxembourg. Is there anything that the government did that really helped push it that you think is something that would be great in another one of these other countries, or made a company scale that was unexpected?
So our general approach is always to listen to companies. And I think that's incredibly important. So we are not making laws and rules to make laws and rules, but the idea is to create an environment where companies in general can thrive, where they have the guardrails, the guidelines, like Geraldine was saying, and I think this is very true for our three countries, the predictability, the business friendliness is there. And this, be it for AI, be it for tech, be it for anything, is our basic approach. So to sit and to listen. I know that our digitization minister was in Paris, set, by the way, with a lot of American companies, to also listen to what they expect, to what they need in Europe. And I think it's these conversations which have to be had. Rulemaking, policy making, strategy making cannot be done in an office in some kind of glass tower somewhere. That's why we are working with organizations like CTA to get the feedback from the industry and to feed it into the policy making.
Geraldine, anything from your point of view, was there a specific government policy or an initiative that you would say really move things along?
Yeah, in relation to AI in particular, a couple of things I'd say. I think one thing that the government regards as really important is to build public trust in what is now a very fast-moving, confusing for the public, if very attractive, development. Our view is the more collaborative the government can be with industry, but with social partners as well, the more that we build up. So we like to say that we approach this from what we call a human-centric point of view, but also an ethical point of view, because the public debate in Ireland, certainly, and I think across Europe, has been marked by a fear about the potential of AI and what it can mean for people's security and livelihoods. But it's also marked by, in Europe, a bigger tug, and we've seen this between the United States and Europe, discussion about the regulatory intervention that I think Europe gets a very bad rap on here. I'll say that up front. So the Irish government has tried, on the one hand, to make sure that the public is accompanying them as we move along. We have dedicated initiatives that are supporting the disruptive technologies, everything from R&D through to working in particular with the big MNCs, who are of course well placed when it comes to the evolution of AI, and the small startups. And we find the cross-pollination between the two in the ecosystem is particularly valuable. And that has a kind of a loop that feeds back into public confidence. Lots of people know startups. They don't always know who's at the top of the big MNC making decisions. That also feeds back into public trust. But then on the regulatory side, I will say Ireland is typically seen in Europe, I think fair to say, I'll be corrected by Nicole, we're a small northern liberal open trading economy. You know, not every country in Europe would describe itself like that. So when we sit at the table in Europe for the discussion on AI and regulatory evolution, that's what we bring to the regulatory debate. We want it simple. We want it clear. We want it manageable, because we want it to facilitate innovation. And I know here in many conversations I've had with industry, as well as maybe some of you in the room, the tendency is to think of Europe as clamping down, providing blockade rather than facilitation. And that isn't our angle of entry. That's much more to open up this. But we are watching the ethical and the human-centric parts of that.
Okay, we're going to come back to that. Rosemary?
I think there's a common theme here, and that is we're all smaller populations, which makes it easier for governments to have that dialogue with business and to know what they need. One of the practical, physical things that our government has done to sort of encourage people into this digital age is to make sure that right across our country, there's been access to high-speed broadband and connecting particularly rural communities. And given our theme of the month, women in business, that's also been designed to help women to take part in the economy and start their own business. But the point about trust and the use of AI, that's also been something our government's focused on, particularly over the last couple of years, conscious of that worry, which I think is a justified one, that there can be sort of difficult sides or unexpected consequences of AI. We found actually that New Zealand startups are pretty quick on the uptake. They've been very quick to make use of AI. I'll just give you three interesting examples. There's one called Toku, which is a Maori name, and that is using AI to actually really super analyze eye scans. You know, if you go to the optometrist, they take a scan, shows all the back of the eye, etc. And this one actually picks up very early signs of other health problems, whether it's diabetes or cardiovascular. Another one in the health sector is a company called Formis, and they do 3D AI analysis of people's joints when they need replacing. And it's a world first, that particular company.
I think I need the name of that company again.
I was just thinking about that for my brother, actually. He's facing a knee operation, so I'm hoping they're using it. And another one, which we are actually quite focused in the health sector, is for electrical impulses in the intestine, in the gut, I'd say more prosaically. And that is actually helpful to people who are suffering from digestive problems. So a heap of really interesting applications of AI, and no doubt there's going to be a lot more of this, but all in the context of being a very open economy with, as both my friends Geraldine and Nicole have said, fairly light but selective and careful regulation.
The thing I worry about is that people will believe that AI is for the elites or for them and not for me. Let's go back to you, Nicole. How does your government deal with that? Or maybe they're not worried about it.
I think they are. And there is a big discussion on that. And the idea is really that AI is for everybody. And Rosemary and Geraldine have said, you know, it has to be safe. People have to trust it. So there is really a deployment. There's a lot of education on AI. I think that's very important. So it starts very, very early on. And the idea is that the applications are very wide. So it's companies, but it's also in the public services. So it's AI in government. A lot of it is still vision and not so much implementation. But we bring it out with education and rallying people around. So the public services is an important part, and education, and then, of course, companies do their bit. So it's being, I would say, introduced slowly. Of course, the big question is also on what jobs are being lost. And I think that's something which is very concerning. In a high service economy like Luxembourg, we actually think it will create more jobs. You know, some jobs will need to be retrained, but we actually see it as a potential for more growth and for more jobs, and that the number of people who have to be retrained or who will lose their jobs because AI will do their jobs will not be so significant. There has been very consistent rollout efforts, I would say, over the last couple of years, trying to really involve everybody in the country.
Geraldine, is Ireland looking closely at reskilling? Are there any initiatives where, again, we're talking about government working with industry? Because all of this innovation, 90% of the innovation, comes from industry, not government. This is all new. So how are you guys handling this?
We are handling it. The engine is in the private sector, but the government in Ireland certainly has recognized that it needs to lead in order to provide the framework and the environment, the ecosystem for industry to flourish. And so we have a new National Skills Council dedicated specifically to looking at right across all industries. Because I think at the beginning there was a sense this would just be the tech industry. Right. But in fact, that's where the elite label emerged. But now it's clear it's everything from energy through to health through to fintech. So we are looking at upskilling right across the board. And there's a government investment in that. The government actually on the R&D front is looking at making sure that businesses themselves are investing as well in their own workforce, but in R&D. So there's a sort of a target there for 2030 of doubling expenditure in the private sector and encouragement there to do that. And that the government would spend 2.5% of our GNI on R&D related to the digital. That's linked to what we're doing with the social partners. So business, industry, the academe, in pushing the whole machine forward at the same time. We're also, you know, because I described to you the Ireland that I was born into, very homogenous, very small. Now we're very diverse. And so we have a big inclusivity part to the work that we're doing, both in driving AI forward, but in upskilling. So making sure in particular that women who, you know, are very high percentage of our STEM graduates are female, but you don't always see it then reflected in the way in which industry is shaped later. So we have a series of dedicated initiatives, Women in Tech Annual Summit, Women in STEM Annual Summits, and our two big government agencies, the Industrial Development Authority, which brings investment back into Ireland, the Enterprise Ireland Agency, which is indigenous, they're at the heart of that conversation on upskilling. So they're bringing back onto the island what they're seeing also by way of trend, need, gap, whether that's here in the United States or in Asia
or indeed in Africa, where we're seeing development. So we're looking beyond the island all the time, but the upskilling is being done in collaborative way for partners. Yeah.
Rosemary, anything specifically New Zealand's doing that could potentially be exported on the skills side, reskilling?
I don't think there is anything that I would add to what's been said. But, you know, we focused a lot on government and what government's doing. But this whole revolution, really, that we're involved in of moving towards societies that are based on AI, it's as much what comes out of the society itself, out of the business community. And I think as much as anything in New Zealand, that debate is happening at social level in business world, as much as in government. I don't think we've actually got to the point yet where we're saying consciously, this is now a skills upgrading strategy that will accompany the introduction and the greater spread of AI. We've certainly focused on getting people digitally aware and educated, and particularly, as Geraldine just mentioned, STEM subjects for women, also for Maori and Pacific communities, our diverse communities. But yeah, I'm sure we're going to have to do that. Everyone is.
Right. I have to say the one thing I also learned in Paris was the incredible amount of women who've created so much of the AI. We see the guys up there, you know, Jan, Mark, all those stars. But the next row down, oh my God, it's all women. It is remarkable how many women have really discovered AI and really push these incredible products out there. We need to get them out there more. So when you're talking to business, when we're talking about Europe, again, the biggest issue was how to get investment, right? How does it work between the countries? Nicole, do you go in there and say, hey, that New Zealand, it's fabulous, but come on, come to Luxembourg. I mean, how do you differentiate, or do you try to share? How does that work?
Of course, there's competition, but there is a lot of collaboration and of cooperation. And especially in the technology revolution where we are, I think we need to collaborate. Like what Geraldine says, of course, we are linked in the EU. We focus on getting the skills, on having people ready for it. It really depends what you need. So some of it, we are very complementary. In some areas, we are more competitors. And Luxembourg, as you know, we are wedged in between France, Germany, and Belgium, which actually means that we don't have our own market. People say, well, go to Luxembourg, doesn't make any sense. But then for a lot of companies, it does, because we are right there in the middle and we have a workforce which is like 50% foreign. So the average amount of languages spoken in Luxembourg per person is 3.6. We have three official languages.
It's embarrassing for the rest of us.
Sorry, I don't want you to feel bad. We have to by necessity, you know, necessity. So we have three official languages, Luxembourgish, German, and French. But English is widely spoken and is really the business language. And all our laws, we translate them into English. Businesses can file in English. So if a company really looks at coming to France and Germany and Italy and Belgium, and they only want to be in one place where they have all the different experts for the German market, for the French market, that is really a very specific thing we have because of our location and because of the makeup of our workforce, which is extremely, extremely international.
One of the complaints in Paris was, okay, we're going to score in Luxembourg, but then when we go to Ireland, we have to start all over, different policies, obviously different government. But is there any way of bringing all of that together? Geraldine, you want to take that?
Yeah, I mean, just as a remark, that's slightly unusual because I'm not so sure how true it is. I think there is a general sense that across Europe, because we cooperate and coordinate, our trade policy is what we call a European competence. So it has a European umbrella, that we're pretty similar. But of course, as Nicole says, it's competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that Ireland certainly likes to promote is that we rank very highly on ease of doing business all the time. And that is in part because particularly for United States, we are an English language environment. We're a common law environment. We have very long standing, and I think this helps us now in this phase, very long standing US investors in Ireland. 9 of the top 10
big tech companies are headquartered for Europe and Ireland. They've been with us for 20 or 30 years. These are not sort of fly-by-night operations. So they know the environment. They know us. We certainly work to retain them. So we facilitate their ongoing investments in Ireland. There's also, I think, in a way, the feed-off of those big MNCs for the new generation. I mentioned the ecosystem. So there's a comfort level for smaller companies coming in almost in the shelter of the big actors into an environment like Ireland. We see that as a competitive asset. And then, of course, there are just the more hard-nosed ways of doing it. We have tax credits for research and development. We have tax credits for innovation. We have tax credits when it comes to certain types of projects. There are indigenous trade. The Enterprise Agency I mentioned is one of the biggest venture capitalists in Europe. So we have hard-nosed instruments, but we have an ecosystem that just bends into attracting. It doesn't mean it's without its challenges. I mean, I wouldn't like people to think it's a slam dunk because this is all uncharted waters that we're in now. We don't know in terms of the international environment how other actors will behave. Nobody so far has mentioned China or Russia.
China signed the Paris Agreement. The US and the UK did not.
Well, there you are. And I'll use my moment here to say it makes no sense for me, for Europe and the United States, not to be in lockstep on the broader regulatory issues in relation to AI, because if not, third country actors will come in and occupy the space. And when there's blue water between us, countries like New Zealand, Ireland, Luxembourg, we're always going to be the same sort of disposition. Other countries are not. And I think that that's a big risk for the whole project, not just for Ireland's competitiveness, but for the broader interest of the evolution of the market, AI writ large. And if you come back to the public trust element earlier, if this becomes a disrupted, uneasy market, it will influence investment. We know that. So we're anxious to keep this moving in a way that the public embrace and that investors feel comfortable investing in.
Rosemary, what about China? And talk about DeepSeek. Did that change anything in New Zealand, as it was a big shock here in the US?
I think it was equally, people really took attention to that. You know, people talk about the satellite moment that goes back to the 50s when the Russians put a satellite up and the US was suddenly feeling they were losing the technology race. But I'll just come back to the point that Geraldine just made about the race to get some form of internationally recognized, not necessarily regulation, but norms, standards and rules that will govern how all like-minded countries, or at least those who want to operate in a proper way. But we're on a real race against time here. I'm not so sure how we're actually going to be able to achieve that, because not just in AI, but, you know, you look at the number of global issues, whether it's climate change or other areas where you need global cooperation, but we seem to be increasingly at risk of not being able to do that cooperation. I just cycle back to the starter question of how to attract investment. We've been a really pure open economy. We don't do subsidies anywhere. And we have also stayed clear of doing tax credits and, you know, the sweeteners that have been used very effectively, I think, and very well by other countries. But we're starting to look at how we do that. And in fact, the government just launched a new organization called Invest New Zealand, which is intended to make it easier to bring foreign investment in. And I think we will increasingly have to make it more attractive. Some of the things that have made it attractive for companies to come to New Zealand, international companies also from the US, is that we have clean energy. More than 85% of our energy is hydro-derived. And that's been quite an important consideration for a number of countries. But it is a competitive process attracting investment. And in New Zealand, we've almost got a race between our innovative capacity, which seems to be growing really fast and very well, and our ability to attract the investment to support it. Because there's no use having a can-do attitude and a can-invent attitude if you can't do capital. So we're at a kind of an interesting inflection point, I think, on that.
One of the notes, again, in Paris was that Mistral, their biggest AI company, is not used by the French government. So other investors, well, if the French government doesn't use it, why should we consider it first rate? I think they're working on that. But is there a lot of adoption of, for example, the AI infrastructure there in government in New Zealand? Or are you looking outside?
I think we're pretty at the early stages. I suspect that my colleagues may be further ahead on that track.
Nicole, to China, if you would please too.
I think what Geraldine launched a discussion is the standard setting, the international standard setting. The approach to Europe and how Europe is approaching regulation is always, oh, you are over-regulating. Your rules are too strict and they crush innovation. I think these are very important conversations we need to have because I think our common objective is the same. We want to spur innovation, but we want to have it safe and we want guardrails for safety. And I would think they should be the same for all of us. And also that people can trust. So, I mean, that's an indirect answer to the China question, but no, actually, a pretty direct answer, I would say.
No, it's a direct answer, and it's a true conundrum, because what does safety even mean? It means something different to everyone here. And what does trust mean? I met this professor again in Paris. He was from Stanford. And somebody said, oh, this is so bad. It's fake, that kind of thing. And he stood up and said, well, I work with young people all the time, and young people don't look at it as, is it true? Is it fake? The assumption is, it's fake, right? So you're talking about a whole generation that's assuming that you have to know, you have to look into it, you have to decide. Well, that's a whole different way for people to go through life globally. So how do you teach that?
Yeah, it's always interesting also talking to my daughters about that. They are now 18, 22. So they do approach it in a very different way because they've grown up as digital nomads from early on. And on the one hand, I find that these kids know so much more. They are so much more risk prone. The fact is, when we were writing our papers, we hand wrote them, and you really had to be sure that every word made sense. And if you made a mistake, it was very complicated to kind of correct it. Now, you copy paste, you move things around, so you can really go for it. So we have actually a generation. They are much more risk prone.
Well, that's why when you say trust, I honestly don't know, how do you decide what's trust?
And I am with you on that, because also trust, I think a lot of it is about personal information. Where is the personal information going? But the people who are...
It's going everywhere.
And the people who are most concerned about that are the ones who put everything out there. So I'm confused about that as well.
Yeah. Let me ask a question to the audience. How many are using ChatGPT? How many are using Perplexity? How many have used DeepSeek? Well, if you're using Perplexity, it's on there, just saying. How many have seen deep research on OpenAI? One person, two, three, here, the ladies here. When you look at that level of information and simplicity of it, and you try to decide in the, you know, fifth column, on the second page, if that's accurate or not, or if it's an opinion. Now, in Perplexity, you can back things up and look at the source and all that sort of stuff. But when you're in that kind of world and it's different, and every single person in here and everywhere is using a different kind of thing, the kind of community and the kind of global alliances that most of us in the room have experienced most of our careers, how does that come together? Oh, God, that's doom and gloom, isn't it? Nicole, it's in your hands. What do you think? I mean, if you could bring all of Europe together and say, okay, guys, this is now what we mean by this is what's fake, this is what's synthetic. What's the answer?
So I always like to look at it. AI is the co-pilot and the human stays the pilot. You like that?
I do. Who else likes that? Okay, good.
So that is one of it, but it also means that you have to be so much more discerning. What I like about Perplexity, barring the DeepSeek connection, is the sources. I am very ill at ease with having thinking done for me without sources. So I find that very unsatisfying because I cannot verify.
You want to know?
I want
you're used to knowing. Rosemary, you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I'm feeling pretty gloomy. I think I'm going to be really a bit dark on this one. I think it's going to be increasingly difficult to maintain social cohesion with this complete, fragmented, absolutely full of choices landscape of information. I just don't know how that's going to work. I think we're going to have to find some new ways to build those bridges and build that cohesion back.
Geraldine?
Yeah, I'm not going to raise the level of optimism. I must say, I personally thought that there was buyer's remorse around the management of the internet and that we would have learned lessons that we would now bring to this next phase. But I actually don't think that that's possible now. I think this has gotten ahead of us in this country. You know, the FCC was a thousand flowers bloom. And again, Europe was regarded as, with the privacy laws and everything, a bit a drag factor on the broader internet, let's put it like that. I don't think we're going to have one pathway or solution. It's going to have to be some balance between what is clearly now sort of market forces that are really taking the lead, where governments really have a responsibility to step in for societal reasons to avoid the fragmentation that Rosemary's talking about. And that brings with it a regulatory responsibility, which is a security issue for society. It's very unpopular to say that.
Really unpopular. Yeah. I mean, just where politics has been going in the opposite direction.
Yeah. But politics may be going in the opposite direction. But, you know, there are broader issues around the whole of the shape of security of our societies. And that if the next generation wants to have a capacity to critically analyze something they're looking at, we need schools that will teach them. We need to introduce concepts that are basically shared and that we all understand as norms. A free-for-all here will lead ultimately to disaster. I don't think there's another word that we can describe. So it can't be a hands-off approach. There has to be a balance in the way that the markets and governments act. And certainly, for example, in Ireland, we're bringing AI into public services. We're lucky still for now in Ireland to have faith in institutions, in government institutions. And so building public trust in their access to personal information, use of delivery of services, that's a baseline. If you can translate that then into your education system, you're at least moving partly along. But if you step right back from all of that and people don't trust the institutions, then the ability to have a shared truth becomes very hard to attain, I would say.
Anyone want to jump in? Anyone have a question?
Can I just jump in?
Please.
Yes, just briefly. I just want to pick up on that point about trust in institutions because, you know, I first came to the US as ambassador in 2018. At that stage, polling showed that something like 80% of the New Zealand population had a high trust in government and institutions broadly. Now, that's gone down to something like 67%. And that's no accident. That is actually in that period that people are starting to take a higher uptake of social media and these disparate forms of information gathering that reinforce their prejudices rather than actually give them something which maybe somebody else might have fact-checked. I think just on the education side, one skill I think we need to really emphasize is critical thinking. I cannot underline this enough, but really judgment, critical thinking. And so you need to bring education up to a much higher level in, you know, even languages. I remember the time when I was in China, I didn't know whether I was buying shampoo or dishwashing liquid or anything. Now I just put my phone and it translates for me. So certain skills we don't need so much anymore, but critical thinking, I think, will just be fundamental.
But where is the system to do that? I mean, it just doesn't exist. Universities do it. There's classes, but it's not part of a regular curriculum.
It's across the board from elementary school onwards. And this is like, what do you call that? An horizontal skill rather than a vertical one.
Okay, I'm going to ask a happier question. We're talking about women this month. We should talk about us every month, let's be honest. But if you can pinpoint one skill you have that helped, I'm going to ask each of you this, be a success. And here, because everyone here knows there's no greater gig. Oh my God, this sounds so terrible, American, to be ambassador in the US of A, right? That's what we think. Don't we think this is the best job they could have as ambassador? All right, we'll put that aside. But what would you say your great skill that has made you so successful, Nicole? I'm going to start with you. And this is inspiration for some of the young women that are here.
Thank you. I think the most important is be yourself and listen and be humble.
You want more?
Yeah. I do. So, I like that.
So, no, I think...
Was there a moment that you had an opportunity because you were humble or careful that you were able to, you know, move forward?
I think it's overall. I mean, our job is... I agree. It's the best job in the world because you get around and you meet people. So our job is about people. So even though we talk about technology, I quintessentially believe that our job is about people and we meet the best people. Sorry, this is my diplomatic skills coming out. So we meet the best people. And I think showing empathy to the others, listen, try to understand, and based on that, take decisions. So I think we have a big responsibility, but it's also, it gives you so much. So, I mean, when I, even from my side, I've been working a lot in the Far East, and but you don't only work in a country. A diplomat doesn't only work, a diplomat lives in a country. And so that means when you live somewhere, everything goes around it, the adaptation, seeing how that country works, how people think. So it's not like one instance, but I could give you many instances, you know, where it's partially also very humbling. When you arrive in China, you cannot even read. It's a very humbling kind of moment when all of a sudden you don't know what you buy or where you go or what you eat. So always having this open-mindedness, listen, trying to understand, and through that, then feed it back into the decisions you do. And even now, you know, what is challenging at the moment is trying to feed back what's happening also in this country and how this country and some people in this country view what is happening. So it's
It's a very challenging time.
It's challenging, but it's exciting. And talking with all of you is helping to demystify that.
That's great. Geraldine?
Yeah, I'm just reminded by Nicole talking about being humble. A colleague of mine said that, you know, for our live ambassadors in particular, you get used to being the most ignorant person in the room every 4 years because you arrive. Imagine you arrive in a new job, a new country, a new office. Everybody around you knows more about what you're supposed to do than you do. So it is very humbling. But I would say in my case, I think adaptability and the capacity to almost chameleon-like, to think yourself into a new situation and lifelong learning. Because, you know, before I came to this job, I was sitting negotiating the Iran nuclear deal at the Security Council, and I'm going up this afternoon on Capitol Hill to discuss trade issues. So you really need to remake yourself. And that capacity to hold on to a core, which is I know what my country's interests are and where they lie and what the core principles are. And then you remake yourself into a useful operative for your country each time. You have to be really flexible, but also ready after. I've had more than 40 years doing what I'm doing, but I have to, again, learn anew each day. So, you know, something like AI as an advent, it's terrifying, but it may not be as terrifying as the first day I walked into the Security Council. So they're all relative for me.
I was going to ask you if you wouldn't mind talking about being on the Security Council at the beginning of the Ukraine war.
Yeah, I was there on the night that the invasion happened. Frankly, I will say, although we don't always believe American foreign policy predictions, the Secretary of State then, Tony Blinken, told us this was happening. And at about 6 o'clock in the evening, we got a message to say we would have to convene in the Security Council around 10 o'clock. And during the meeting of the council, the phones literally were flashing, including for the Russian permanent representative who was chairing that meeting. So the news that they had crossed into invade Ukraine, they were the aggressor, no doubt about that, was just unbelievable. And in fact, it happened with such
an immediacy that in the Security Council, there's a speakers list. There are only 15 of us. So, you know, the first three or four of us had spoken. And I can only remember, it's all about me, that I had spoken. And Linda Thomas-Greenfield had spoken. And there was one other country. So we thought, what are we going to do now? Because the invasion's happened. We need to come back in. So we had to, we were texting and we got an agreement that we would come back in to then decry what had just happened. It was the most, certainly in my career, the most shocking moment that I've ever witnessed. And as a European, I mean, I've said Ireland is this tiny little island dropped out there in the Atlantic. We're not physically, obviously, attached to Europe, but it's our backyard. And never in my lifetime did anybody on the island of Ireland, and certainly no one in my career frame, ever imagined Europe could be at war again. And that was the big shock factor. Something tectonic plate-like shifted that night. And sadly, those plates are still shifting. So there's no doubt about it. It was, you know, front row seat at history in a way, but at a terrible price for the people of Ukraine and for Europe.
And just the day before and the days before, you're working with the Russians.
Yeah, my Russian colleague, you know, good pal of mine, classical diplomat, ironically, one of the only people at the UN who had ever read Finnegan's Wake. A lot of people had read Ulysses, but nobody had read Finnegan's Wake. I got on with him very well. So we, as the members of the council, we had informal ways of communicating, and there was a lot of chit-chat that we enjoyed, a lot of socializing. But over time, that all, you know, over the days that followed, when it became clear this would not reverse itself, that all got cut off. And the chemistry between the 15 totally shifted, and it became so hard to do business. One of the last big pieces of business I did before I left the council to come here was a negotiation on the Syria humanitarian cross-border resolution, where you absolutely had to have the United States and Russia on board. And I was the negotiator. And so in the previous year, we could all go in one room and sit and try and work our way through. Calls would be made, nights would be spent. But this time there was no question that that could happen. So it was shuttle diplomacy, meeting with the Russians and their mission, going to the Americans. You know, it just changed everything from then on.
Rosemary, do you think about when Geraldine talks about that period of time 3 years ago, do you think about how technology has changed? If, say, all of that started a war or just some sort of confrontation, global confrontation, with the kind of issues we're talking about, trust, safety, and all of that, does it make you more worried? Or do you feel confident that there's some sort of systems in place to talk about these issues?
Geraldine just referred to the WhatsApp signal and other such communications. In a way, they're a complication to diplomacy, but in another way, they're a partial solution, because when you're in a difficult spot or maybe even a, you know, impending conflict kind of spot, sometimes, not always, and certainly not in this case, sometimes the personal relationships among the principals can actually be helpful in fending off the problem that looks like it's going to happen. What's new in my career, which is slightly longer than Geraldine's, but not all that much, but we've both seen a lot of change. Those kind of conversations happened over telephone calls. They were set up with other diplomats in the room, with the minister or the prime minister or the president. You know, it was all very carefully prepared. That doesn't happen now. The prime ministers probably all chat to each other without the diplomats or the ambassadors even knowing what they're saying. Sometimes we find out afterwards if we're lucky. But, you know, that's changed the nature of things. And talking about multilateral diplomacy, I did my first posting in Geneva at the UN. In those days, you know, if you wanted to communicate with another delegation during a meeting, you had to get somebody to run over and drop a note on their desk. And that always made you feel really important, you know, if somebody came over and dropped a note on your desk. These days, you just do it all by text, and it's very efficient. But, you know, you might also be saying, gosh, have you seen somebody? Have you seen their hair today? You know, what have they done? I'm sure you had moments of relaxation like that at the UN. So in other words, it's a blessing and a problem at the same time.
can I just add a tidbit? So in the various, while we were on the Security Council, we were five women. So I used to call us the G5. And we had our own group, our own chat group. And there was no group more interesting to our male colleagues than our chat group. They were dying to know what was in our chat group. They certainly never found out.
Well, ladies, thank you so much for being here today. You're incredible. A true inspiration. Thank you for what you do for your countries, but also for the U.S.
Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.